Yes, well, thank you very much, first of all, to the organizers for the opportunity to speak about some recent work at this meeting. Now, what I would like to talk about today is I would like to present to you a new set of quantum field theories, quantum field theories of a type where we are perhaps not so customized to, namely field theories which do not display asymptotic freedom. Now, as we all know, asymptotic freedom is such a corner piece in the standard model that you might wonder why you would want to give this up. So our curiosity in this type of question has been motivated by actually gravity. Some people speculate that this type of new behavior may be relevant for gravity, but as a matter of fact, it may as well exist elsewhere in quantum field theory, namely in totally conventional field theories such as extensions of the standard model. So in order to motivate you to you this type of topic, let me say a few words initially. So my starting point is, of course, the standard model, which I think is a beautiful cornerstone of how local quantum field theory can make reliable predictions, which are beautifully confirmed by high energetic experiments relating this to the strong, weak, and electromagnetic force. It covers a large range of degrees of freedom, even including, most recently, spin zero, the Higgs particle, which has finally arrived. Now, the most important sentence here, of course, is the last one. Yes, this is a framework in which we have a computationally accessible theory, which allows us to make reliable predictions. Now, what are the downsides of the standard model? Why are we here? And why are we looking for extensions? Okay. Now, the standard model has a few problems. So certainly, the Higgs sector is not particularly well understood. And also, we don't understand as of yet how we can properly incorporate and understand up to highest energies the U1 sector of the standard model. So in a sense, the way we presently have to look at the standard model is that we have to view it as a low energy effective theory up to some highest energy, at which it has to be superseded by something else. So that's motivation number one. Motivation number two for me is actually the question on how ultimately gravity or a quantum version of gravity might fit into the beautiful framework of our standard model. Now, the avenue which I'd like to offer you today is an avenue which puts the notion of interacting high energy fixed points into the center stage. And in order to work my way towards it, let me first review why ultraviolet fixed points are so important. And again, experimental evidence is one of the core features here, namely the important triumph of quantum field theory, the measurement of the running strong nuclear coupling constant, which by now has been extended to up to the order 1 TeV in energy scales, and very beautifully predicts or coincides with the theory prediction, which states that, in fact, the running strong coupling constant should become weaker and weaker if we go to higher energies. Of course, the physics picture underneath this, this curve here, is that the fluctuations of, say, gluon and quark fields soften the strong nuclear interactions in such a way that it asymptotically approaches zero. So the well-known phenomena of asymptotic freedom. Now, in terms of equations, there's a very simple way of writing it down. It has been discovered back in 74. So one loop order, we know that the energy dependence of the strong nuclear coupling constant is given by a very simple equation, namely the one loop beta function with some numerical coefficient b, which turns out to be positive. So this states that if we go to higher energies, the slope, the rate of change is negative, so the coupling wants to become weaker and weaker. But the core point here is that this beta function, in fact, has a fixed point being strong coupling constant equal to zero. Okay, so necessarily, the fluctuations of both gluon and quark fields drive the coupling towards zero. This is why the fixed point is so particularly important. Now, the other reason for why we totally love ultraviolet fixed points goes back to Wilson himself, who even before the discovery of QCD and the running coupling for QCD, observed that in order to have a meaningful path integral at all, which remains predictive up to highest energies, we would want to have, we would want this theory to develop an ultraviolet fixed point in order to ensure that RG trajectories remain finite and the theory remains finite and predictive up to highest energies. So far, so good. Now, in the standard model, however, we also have other interactions, such as the U1 sector, or Higgs coupling, or even many Yukawa interactions. Now, as you all know, these interactions on their own do not display the feature of asymptotic freedom. And in fact, in perturbation theory, their beta functions start out positive. Now, in the language of fixed points, this means these theories have beautiful infrared fixed points, but they do not display ultraviolet fixed points as far as we know for now. Okay, so in particular, like if you think of the quartic Higgs coupling, the quartic Higgs coupling might either run into Landau pole, or it might actually develop an instability, neither of which makes the entire setup a physically meaningful theory. So people have, of course, looked into it, and people have given clear answers as to how this can be cured. So the answer to this is this. If we manage to write down a theory which couples these degrees of freedom, which by themselves would not become asymptotically free, but if you find ways of properly coupling them, to couple them directly or indirectly to non-abelian gauge fields, then we can write down quantum field theories which are completely asymptotically free, meaning asymptotically free in all couplings, including quartics, Yukawa couplings. Okay, so these conditions have been developed in the late 70s. Okay, I made a little table for you what we know about those conditions. So we know that scalars on their own or scalars with fermions have no way of becoming an asymptotically free series. But as soon as non-abelian gauge fields are hanging about, yes, these either with fermions or with scalars or with both of them can develop a totally controlled, complete asymptotically free fixed point, meaning a free fixed point in all the couplings I mentioned a minute ago. Good. This, to some extent, is where we are still standing when it comes to an ultraviolet, fundamental ultraviolet fixed point in a quantum field theory with standard model-like degrees of freedom. Okay? And this is the reason for why, evidently, asymptotic freedom of the non-abelian gauge interaction is playing such a prominent and important role in it. Good. So much for as a review. So what I'm going to do next is something very drastic. I want to invite you to give up on asymptotic freedom, despite of its central role in this entire discussion. I would like to show you that we nevertheless can go quite some way to develop meaningful fundamental quantum field theories, despite of the fact that asymptotic freedom is no longer realized in these theories. Okay, so in order to do that, I'd like to be as simple as it gets. So you will see a crystal clear derivation of all these results, and I hope that you will be able to follow them, and I will be very happy to discuss all these steps with you. Now, to begin, let me show how the mechanism is going to work. Okay, so let's imagine we have a quantum field theory with some coupling alpha, whose beta function in perturbation theory looks like this. So you see there are two terms, 1, which goes with alpha squared, so that's evidently the one loop coefficient. But in this model, I've also allowed myself to write down a term which is linear in the coupling. So as you know, these terms can only arrive if the corresponding coupling has a non-trivial canonical mass dimension, for example, in series which perturbatively are non-renormalizable, in which case the number A is positive. The number B is computable in perturbation theory, and I shall not worry about its value for now. Good. So let's have a look into this beta function. What are the possible fixed points? So clearly, the theory has a fixed point alpha equals 0. Simply means that each term individually vanishes, so the Gaussian fixed point is still there. But the theory can also develop an interacting fixed point. Now, the interacting fixed point arises when the loop term cancels out the tree-level term. Now, if furthermore, A is positive, as I said, that would correspond to theories where we normally would think they are perturbatively not renormalizable. Yes, and the coefficient B, the coefficient B is also positive, then the Gaussian fixed point is an infrared fixed point. And this interacting fixed point necessarily is a high-energy ultraviolet fixed point. Now let's have a look into how the beta functions look like. So of course, if A would be 0, and B positive, of course we fall back onto the QCD-like beta function we've seen a minute ago. Okay, and we know already that this theory has a Gaussian ultraviolet fixed point. But now, if A is positive, the slope gets out positively here, but then at some point the one loop coefficient takes over and develops an interacting fixed point for this beta function. Now let's have a look what this means for this theory. This theory would have two fixed points, a UV and an infrared fixed point. And so we can simply integrate the beta function and plot it. So we would have a beautiful ultraviolet finite trajectory running out of the UV fixed point, crossing over to the infrared, and then ending up in some infrared-free theory. Okay? Now, of course, the role of the UV fixed point now is, had the one loop term not be able to compensate the tree level growth, the coupling would have continued to grow infinitely, and that's what we in perturbation theory would have observed. And the normal conclusion would then have been, okay, if this is not going to happen, this theory is not going to be predictive beyond some energy scale because our coupling is going to diverge. Okay, so the role really here of this term, or actually the fixed point, is to stop the growth of the coupling and to settle it on a fixed point. Good. Now, that's the core mechanism which is underneath each and every asymptotically safe quantum field theory. Okay? Now, you might wonder, okay, how can that be predictive? We know that asymptotically free quantum field theories are predictive, but now if we have such a fixed point, how is this going to be predictive? 2 points. Firstly, I said already that the fluctuations are responsible to help the coupling achieve a fixed point, so therefore, at the fixed point, the coupling remains finite rather than growing infinitely. So then at the fixed point, the theory is going to be characterized by both relevant, marginal, and irrelevant direction in the same way as we know this from critical phenomena in condensed matter systems. As long as we only have a finite set of relevant operators in the UV, yes, we will have beautiful predictivity with the setup. Only if the theory develops infinitely many relevant operators, we would, technically speaking, lose predictivity. Okay. So from that point of view...
When you say predictivity, you mean in a perturbative sense? Or
no.
Just general.
Say, I gave you a perturbative, an example motivated by perturbation theory, but this type of reasoning also applies non-perturbatively. Okay. So predictivity really means that, say, in a sense, for each relevant coupling, we have one free parameter, which then needs to be determined, say, by experiment. But if we have infinitely many, it is not crystal clear whether this really is still predictive or not, and most likely it isn't. Good. Now, when is this simple picture I just described reliable? Okay. So, or in other words, when can we trust perturbation theory for an ultraviolet fixed point? So what we really need is that the coupling A over B at the fixed point is arbitrarily small. Now, how can we achieve that? Theoreticians came up with two main ideas. One goes back to Wilson. Let's use the epsilon expansion and let's imagine we live in a space-time dimensionality which is epsilon away from an integer. Then we can use epsilon as a small control parameter. And then the fixed point will be of order epsilon. The other trick which people have invented is large N techniques. So imagine you have a quantum field theory with very many degrees of freedom. Then the one loop coefficient can become parametrically large of order N. So in the case where A is of order unity and B is of order N, you again can achieve a reliable ultraviolet fixed point in the perturbative domain. So these are the two territories where hard theory results are available. Now this is the complete list of quantum field theories where people have proved that this type of fixed point exists. Okay? So it actually goes back to first attempts of actually finding asymptotically safe fixed points in gravity by these gentlemen, where alpha is then given by G Newton multiplied by an appropriate power of your RG scale. But it also holds true for purely fermionic theories, where we know that above two dimensions as well, these theories, say, Gauss-Neuville type models, are perturbatively not renormalizable in quantum field theory. Yet, we know that these theories develop an interacting ultraviolet fixed point, at least in the limits I just discussed. Now, Peskin already back in 1980 also showed that if we play that game with QCD and imagine that QCD would be living in 4 plus epsilon dimensions, then this theory will also develop an interacting UV fixed point. And finally, nonlinear sigma models, okay, so scalar field theories where the internal symmetry is realized nonlinearly. Here we know that above two dimensions, these theories are technically non-renormalizable, yet some of these theories are actually develop nice interacting UV fixed points. Good. So, now that's the example sheet. Now there's one odd thing on this page, which is that we have examples in very many dimensions, none of which is integer. Actually, there is an example with an integer dimensionality which is d equals 3, where this fermionic proof has been made. But until very recently, we had no working examples for a strictly four-dimensional quantum field theory. And this is where I would like to show you now how the identical mechanism applies and is generating for us an interacting ultraviolet fixed point. So, let's stick from now on to d equal 4 dimensions. Okay? What I would like to start with is I would like to start with some SU-engage theory with a running beta function. So we already have seen the one loop coefficient, which I call minus capital B. Now, because I'm going to prepare for a large N limit, which I'm going to take in a minute, I already have scaled the number of colors into my definition of the gauge coupling. Now, of course, at one loop level, we only have one term. There's no term proportional to A because the canonical mass dimension of the strong coupling or the SUN coupling vanishes. So in order to possibly see a fixed point, we at least have to go to the two-loop order. Okay. Now, the other thing which we already can fix now is that since we know we have asymptotic freedom for positive B, so if we look for an interacting UV fixed point, we are essentially bound to take B negative. Good. So let's switch on the two loop coefficient. Some number, capital C, times alpha cubed. So what are the potential fixed points we can get? Well, as we said a minute ago, it's the trivial one. That's the fixed point we have if each and every term vanishes. Fine. But there's a non-trivial one, which arises because 2 and 1 loop cancel out each other. So, how are we going to make this a reliable analysis? Again, for this fixed point to be reliably in the perturbative domain, we need B over C as small as we wish. And it is here where we apply a trick developed by an idea developed by Gabriele Veneziano quite some time back. So we imagine that we take very, very many colors. So we send NC to infinity. But at the same time, we send NF to infinity, the number of fermion flavors, in such a way that the ratio of these two numbers is fixed. Now, if we do that, the ratio of these two numbers can be any real number we want it to be. So what we are going to use is we fix both NF over NC in such a way that NF over NC minus 11 over 2 is a small, an arbitrarily small number, as small as we want it to be. Now, of course, as you all know, this 11 over 2, you know, where does this come from? Comes from the fact that the number B, the one loop coefficient, is proportional to epsilon. So in other words, what we are really doing here is we make the one loop coefficient of the gauge beta function as small as we want it to be, and we are preparing to use that number as our perturbative control parameter to make an expansion. Good. So that sets the stage for now. So let's see what is the first lesson we learn.
So you have given up on A?
There is no A, because A would be there if we are away from four dimensions, absolutely. Okay, that's why we have to go at least to the second loop order. Now here come...
You go from... These are marginal.
Yes, yes, absolutely. So here comes the first result. First result has been achieved by Coswell back in 74. So back then he noticed, if you play this game, there's no way for achieving an interacting ultraviolet fixed point. The reason being that no matter what, this number C comes out positive. So if, as we said, minus B is also positive, then there is no way these two terms can ever cancel. Okay? So this is a hard result, because this hard result tells us that there's no way of achieving an interacting ultraviolet fixed point of gauge theories coupled to fermions only within perturbation theory. Good. So, what's the lesson? The lesson is that we might have to take other degrees of freedom into consideration. Now, since we have the Higgs, it might seem reasonable to also take scalar degrees of into consideration. Now, if we speak about scalars, it means we should and ought to write down Yukawa interactions. So we have to correct this picture by including Yukawa interactions due to scalars. How will they look like? Let me write down a typical Yukawa coupling Y between scalars and fermions. Okay, and so the notation I use is I use y squared at the end in my beta functions. I rescale it with nc to prepare for a large, or to execute the large n limit, and I call the whole thing alpha y. Okay? The way this coupling is going to appear is it will generate a term which is quadratic in alpha g and linear to linear power in alpha y, and it has some coefficient which I call minus d. Typically, D comes out positive. But now, we have a second coupling in the game. Okay? So in order to answer any questions about UV fixed points, we also must take into consideration the beta function of the Yukawa coupling. There's no other way. Now, the leading non-trivial order is going to be one loop. So how does it look like at one loop? Any Yukawa coupling is going to look like this. Yes, there is a positive coefficient E. Why positive? Because that sector is not asymptotically free on its own, minus the contribution coming from the gauge field. So F also being some positive number, you know, determined by group theoretical coefficients. Okay, so that's our setup. Now we have two coupled beta functions, and we can look for interacting fixed points. Now the answer is this. If and only if this combination of the two loop coefficients in the gauge beta function and the one loop coefficient in the Yukawa beta function, only if this relation is fulfilled, the theory can display an interacting ultraviolet fixed point in perturbation theory. Okay. Good. So this is going to be a necessary but not a sufficient condition. So
that's a determinant?
Well, it looks like a determinant, but really it is, you know, it relates certain two-loop coefficients, C and D, with certain one-loop coefficients, E and F. Okay, and only if this relation is fulfilled. So now you could say, okay, let me sit down, okay, and compute these numbers for all sorts of theories. Okay, and let's see what we get. So I will give you now a completely worked out explicit example of a quantum field theory which has this property.
Why do you not have to worry about scalars or interactions so far?
Yeah, very good point. Of course. The reason being, and I have been simplistic in one respect here, okay? If the scalars have phi to minus phi type symmetry, yes, then we typically don't have cubic vertices. So if you only have quartic vertices, the earliest the vertex explicitly will appear is on the three loop order in these beta functions. That's the reason. So you don't see the coupling, but the scalars have already contributed. The scalars, so if the scalars are, even if the scalars are not charged, okay, the scalars have contributed here. Yes, and also in these beta functions. Okay, so the scalar degrees of freedom are propagating to generate these numbers. It's only that the quartic coupling has not made itself visible explicitly.
What about the quartic coupling beta function?
I speak about that one in my explicit model.
So very the sign of D and F is zero.
So typically the signs are C, D, E, and F positive. Yes. Good.
So can you actually have a system where the quartic coupling is non-asymptotically free?
We have not found a single one.
So the quartic coupling will have to be tuned to zero?
Yes. No.
Or the ramp to zero?
No.
Its own.
Yes. It has an interacting fixed point. I will show it to you in a minute.
Okay.
Yes, but it's an interesting question. We were thinking about that ourselves. Okay, so let's get explicit. Let's take an example which we've tested. It works. Okay, as you engage theory, here, NC colors. Let's take NF flavors in, say, the fundamental representation. Okay, so they are charged under the gauge symmetry, and they have Yukawa interactions with some scalar field H. Now, H is a matrix. It has flavor indices, but it does not have color indices. So we take it as not being charged under the gauge symmetry. Okay. Now in the scalar sector, because H is a matrix, it means that we have a kinetic term. You see round derivatives, so no charge. But because it's a matrix, we have two independent quartic interactions. Let's call them U and V. Okay. So this is our theory. And we take a large NF and NC limit as discussed a minute ago. Now the couplings, I've introduced already alpha G for you and alpha Y. And now I also rescale the two quartics for you. One of them scales with one power of flavors and the other one with the second power of the flavors simply because one of the couplings is proportional to a single trace and the other one is proportional to a double trace. Okay? Good.
So you have NF square complex scalar?
Yes. Okay? And I put myself now into the parametric regime where epsilon is a small control parameter given in this way.
But they really contribute to the beta, to B, the scale of B contributes
to capital B? No. Capital B is the one loop coefficient, only the charged particles contribute to that one. Okay, and so the scalars in this version, at least, they are not charged under the gauge group. But they speak with all the fermions. Good. So that's our theory. Okay. Let's look into the beta function. So these are the beta function to leading non-trivial order, meaning two loop for the gauge, one loop for the Yukawas and the quartics. So first thing to notice, of course, the one loop coefficient is positive now because we have epsilon positive. So the beta function of the gauge starts out like this, and evidently the theory is not going to be asymptotically free. But now come three totally important minus signs. And these minus signs make the entire story work out. So the first minus sign, you've seen a glimpse of it in the general argument I made a minute ago. But let's state the obvious again. Remember, this is now the term here. I've factored out an alpha g squared. This is now the two-loop term of the gauge. This is the two-loop term due to the Yukawas. They appear with a relative minus sign. And it is because of this relative minus sign that the growth, which you would expect because the beta function comes out positively, so the growth induced by that could potentially be stopped thanks to the Yukawa interaction theory. But that's not all, because that would not be sufficient. So let's look into the Yukawa interactions. But now you see the same happens here. We have the Yukawa interactions with a positive term and a minus sign in front of the gauge contribution. So again, these two guys, in principle, could cancel out and generate thereby an exact interacting fixed point. Last but not least, so that's the new thing, let's discuss the scalar sector. Let's start with the single trace quartic coupling beta H first. Okay? This is the most relevant coupling. The double trace quartic coupling is very much like a spectator. It doesn't couple back to the running of these three beta functions. So in essence, this coupling is going to be driven externally by the other coupling. But this coupling is going to couple back at a higher loop order to the other guys. So how does it look like? We recognize here this term, which is the usual lambda squared term of quartic phi to the fourth theory with a positive sign, telling us that this theory is not asymptotically free. But again, these terms, so then there is another term coming from the Yukawa with this positive sign, okay? But there is a second term from the Yukawa which comes with a negative sign. And this term can outbalance the quartic coupling and generate a positive fixed point for the quartic interactions. Had that sign been a negative sign, yes, we still could have made a fixed point, but the problem would have been that fixed point lives at negative lambda quartic coupling, which again would be unphysical. So these three minus signs are very, very important for the existence of this fixed point. Last comment, now the double trace quartic. If you look into the beta function, you will observe that all terms have positive signs. Okay, and I just argued that we are going to have a positive fixed point for alpha g, alpha y, and alpha h. So there's no way the double trace quartic is going to be positive. It must be negative, or else that beta function is not going to have a zero. Okay, so what is this telling us? It tells us that we have to check carefully that the scalar field potential is bounded from below, because one of these quartics is going to have a negative value at the fixed point. I will come back to that in a minute, and I will show you that this is the case. But that's a condition which is not automatically embedded in the construction of this fixed point. Okay. So.
D is an F positive in this model. What you call D and F manifest positive in this model. Here's the notation.
Yes. Yes, of course. D, yes. C, D, E, F are all manifestly positive. Yes.
So what is the cross product?
I haven't written it down, but you see here, I mean, this.
So you have the conditions of EF was larger than AC or something.
Yes. So I'm claiming that that is the case, but I haven't written down that expression in this concrete example. But I will show you the fixed point in a minute. So then you can deduce it from the fixed point, in fact. Okay. So these are our beta functions. So now the philosophy of solving them is, okay, we take our game seriously. We consider epsilon as the small parameter, and we now make a totally systematic expansion in epsilon. We look for fixed points, so the fixed points are going to be power series in the parameter epsilon. This is the result of the following theory. So we see these two guys. So they are analytical expressions, of course, but they look ugly, so I gave you the numbers, okay? So it's of the order of epsilon, the fixed point for the gauge. The fixed point for the Yukawa as well, for the quartic, for the single trace quartic, and we find a negative value for the double trace quartic. We also pushed this computation to the next order, which means we retain. So how does the systematic works now? Okay, if we go to the next loop order, it means we would have to take three loops in the gauge. This gives an alpha to the 4 correction to this beta function. Okay. So in the vicinity of this fixed point, this will be in higher order epsilon correction to it. Okay. So the reason for why this fixed point is exact is exactly this. Right? We can make a power series controlled by perturbation theory, and the next order is not going to affect the leading order result. The next orders are going to affect the subleading order, so they affect epsilon squared coefficients, and then the next orders are going to affect the epsilon cubed values. Okay? Good. So that's the fixed point. Yes, there was no way of tuning anything else other than taking a choice of field content and then evaluating its RG beta functions up to some order. So let's see what this fixed point is telling us. So what I've plotted here for you is kind of phase diagram, okay? So let's forget a split second about the other quartic couplings. They are running by themselves. What let's do is if we could project simply onto the gauge versus Yukawa plane. Now in this plane we have a non-trivial fixed point now, but we also have the Gaussian. All the arrows, so you see a couple of trajectories which I've plotted for you, okay? So along these, the arrow points towards the infrared. So, what is this telling us? This plot tells us that the Gaussian really has become a totally attractive infrared fixed point. There's not a single trajectory which can get out of it. All trajectories run into this fixed point. Now, conversely, why is this an ultraviolet fixed point? It is an ultraviolet fixed point because we have trajectories which can run out of that fixed point. Not all of them, so this one is not running out of it. But this one, or that one, along either of these trajectories, we have a totally well-defined local quantum field theory, which remains predictive up to arbitrarily high energies, thanks to the existence of this fixed point. Okay? So there's a trajectory running down, means we have a weakly coupled theory in the UV. It would then cross over to something which, in the infrared, becomes a free theory, say like QED. Or the second option would be, actually, we have another possibility where we run into this direction. So we again have the same ultraviolet fixed point, but into this direction, we won't end up in a theory which at low energies is strongly coupled. So this theory might display confinement and chiral symmetry breaking, or it may even display a non-perturbative infrared fixed point and conformal scaling. That we don't know just based on perturbation theory. Okay? But on either of these trajectories, we have a totally predictive theory up to highest energies. Now, You can now say, okay, good, these are two couplings, so let's see how the phase diagram looks like if we switch on the other couplings. Well, then the phase diagram looks a bit more complicated. Of course, we can't plot it with the four couplings, but with three we can. Okay, so you then again see the separatrix here connecting the ultraviolet fixed point with the infrared fixed point down here, or running up into the other direction. Okay, good. Now, another thing we can do is we can now look in more detail on how beta functions look like on our asymptotically safe trajectories. Okay, so what would we do? We project, we simply evaluate them, and then what are we going to see? Aha, we do see initial growth down here, no asymptotic freedom, but then the quantum fluctuations due to the fermions and the scalar fields make sure that the gauge beta function crosses over and indeed develops an interacting ultraviolet fixed point in exactly the same way as we discussed a minute ago in the toy model. Okay? You can make the very same plot for the Yukawa coupling, and no surprise, you will have a very similar outcome. Okay? And you can do it for the quartics if you want. Good. Now, let's look how the couplings are running when we go from the UV to the IR. Okay, so gauge coupling makes a nice crossover and asymptotically goes to a free fixed point. Very similar to the plot we've seen a minute ago in our little toy model. Okay, it's exactly the same type of behavior, only the complexity is now a tiny bit increased because we have more degrees of freedom and more couplings. So the Yukawa coupling showing the very same behavior here. The double trace quartic, starting out negative at the fixed point, now going back to zero. Now, I've also plotted for you here the sum of the single trace and the double trace quartic coupling. And the reason for why I did it is because one can show, and I'll show you some elements of the proof in a minute, that in order for this theory to be globally stable, okay, we need that the sum of these two couplings remains positive. Okay, so we know it is positive at the fixed point, and actually we can follow it along the entire trajectory, and it remains positive. So we know that the theory is quantum mechanically fully stable with a well-defined quartic potential. Good.
So this is a sufficient condition to have a potential bounded from below?
Yes. Okay, so I gave you a necessary condition, which was a relation about two and one loop coefficients in gauge and Yukawa couplings. That's a necessary condition, and the sufficiency condition, of course, is that if this theory then also has a proper fixed point in the scalar sector, that the corresponding potential is bounded.
I don't think that that is a tuning question, because to the UV fixed point, you have to tune the couplings, and depending on how close you tune, that determines how long the system stays around the UV and how far it runs in the infrared. Mm-hmm. So in the previous plot that you showed, I would think that those sudden change curves, mm-hmm. Those regions could be moved left or right for each and every coupling depending on how I tune it. So I can imagine that by tuning the alpha V closer to the UV fixed point, the sum will become negative at some point. So there is no guarantee that in any case you have a positive potential.
Yes, there is complete guarantee that I have a positive potential, because no matter what I do, mm-hmm. in the UV, the sum of these two couplings is positive. So whichever way you try to construct to reach the UV, the sum of these two guys is going to be positive.
Yeah, but can I have something where alpha H mm-hmm. is not tuned, or tune lesser, but I don't know how to say that, but that alpha h goes to zero soon, while alpha b remains negative for much longer energies, and then the sum will be negative.
I'm afraid that's not possible. Okay, so the results we have prove that that is not possible. Okay, and maybe the next one of the next transparencies is perhaps giving a hint into this. Okay, the reason being that so something I have not yet spoken about, but which implicitly was on the slide. Okay, if you think of what it means that you have a phase diagram like this. Okay, so we see. I've been speaking about these two distinguished trajectories, okay? But there are other trajectories, okay, along which we cannot reach the ultraviolet fixed point. So, in one way of stating the obvious is that we have a one-dimensional ultraviolet hypercritical surface, to which at the very end of the day, couplings must be tuned. So then, because in this particular example, this surface is one-dimensional, there is going to be a hard relation linking all these couplings. So you have more freedom to play around if that is two- or three-dimensional, and then, of course. Okay. But I will come to that now, because, of course, the obvious thing...
So Daniel, the scale when they clip over is arbitrary, correct?
Yes. Yeah, in some say so the scale where this clips over, okay, it's like lambda QCD. So you relate it.
Yeah, you can sit anywhere on that line in the inferno.
Yes. So the point with this line.
But they go together because there is only one couple.
Yeah. So the point of this line is that you have to get the running started. You cannot be exactly at the UV fixed point. So you need to be a tiny bit away. Meaning that at some large RG scale, mu. You have to tell us how far away with dimensionless parameters you are. And this then gets converted into the non-perturbative scale at which this crossover happens. It's exactly like in QCD.
You have to take the masses to zero at every step, right? That's
yeah, so we are taking, we are speaking about massless theories, okay, but of course it does work even if you have masses hanging around.
Sure. So you have a dangerous region in the coupling. Space, and bounded theory. So the flow near the boundary, do you have any indication where they go? Because what you say is that if you tune to the UV point, you stay away from that region. But
you have a good point. So your question, your question is, we have a beautifully stable potential in the UV, and if we flow away, are our potentials continue to remain beautifully stable or not? Okay. Yeah. So the answer here is definitely yes. Okay. In the perturbative regime where we have full control, because there we can solve these equations even analytically. So we see that. Okay. It's more. Yeah. Sorry.
If you allow for a quadratic term of the scalars, then you get two relevant directions.
Yes. Then the mass. Yeah.
And then this happens.
Of course. The mass is also a relevant operator in that case, no doubt.
So the mass you tune to zero.
Yeah. So this is the simplest example with...
Question that, but how many relevant directions are there at the UV fixed point?
We see
that there is only one.
Plus, in the massless theory, there's one, but the mass evidently is always a UV relevant operator.
I'm not worried about the mass.
Yeah. So then in this theory there's one. Okay, but you can end up with theories which have more than one. That depends really on the structure of these loop coefficients. Okay. Yes. But the converse is also true. So we can show that in this example with four couplings, there's no way of getting four relevant ones. You might, it could, it's not excluded that you can get three, but we don't have an example for that.
Yeah, what is the parameter you would change to get more than? Well, if you don't do that.
Yes, now, well, if you want to have more relevant directions, what you have to do is this, okay? One way of looking at it is like this. Think of the quartic beta function, which is a quadratic function in, say, lambda. Okay? So if this beta function has two zeros at positive lambda, then you might end, okay? So it's like, okay, it's very simple. Yes? If you, how do you get more? You get more if your beta quartic, it looks like this in at one loop order. Okay? So now the only question is, where are the zeros of this function? Okay, if the zeros axis is here, we don't have a fixed point. If the zero axis is here, we might have two fixed points. Okay? But if the other zero axis is here, only this one could be physical. But if this one is physical, the slope is positive. So it is an irrelevant direction at the fixed point. So only if you manage to construct a theory with all the conditions I stated, where beta lambda looks like this, then this guy is a candidate offering a second relevant direction.
How can you have a beta function that's not zero and zero?
Because I am plotting it over lambda, and you have to remember that we now have more than one coupling. And so, for example, if the scalar is charged, there can be terms which go like g to the fourth with no lambda in it when lambda is zero. Okay? And the same, so these things can happen. Okay? So yes, because you have so many couplings.
So it's tricky. One shouldn't plot it in a one-dimensional.
No, but the qualitative argument is correct. Yes? So the argument is, this model is in the scenario where this fixed point exists. There's a second fixed point, but that one is unphysical. So if some theory can move this line over, then the second fixed point will become a relevant direction. Without changing the direction in the Gage-Yukawa sector, remember that one was independent of the quartic. Okay, so this is in fact why we can disentangle this discussion. Okay.
So the theory you define from the UV to the Gaussian is a trivial, completely trivial.
That's a completely trivial theory. Okay. Yes, so it's nice to know that such a type of theory exists, but of course you would probably find it a tiny bit boring. Yes, it's in the high energy limit, it's a weakly coupled gauge theory, okay, because the fixed point value of the coupling is small, and in fact we want it to reside in the territory of perturbation theory, and then it becomes even weaker coupled, but technically asymptotically free, or infrared free in the infrared. So the more interesting theory from a theory perspective, of course, would be, I guess, the other one, the one, you know, which runs out into this direction. And maybe to see, so now, okay, you can think of it continuously, okay? So think about epsilon as a continuous parameter. This distance roughly is epsilon. So you can think of putting epsilon back to zero, through zero to negative values. What would happen? When epsilon is negative, we again must fall back into the territory where the theory is asymptotically free. So let's do it on the phase diagram. So you take this fixed point, you pull it all the way down. At epsilon zero, we have a degenerate Gaussian one. You pull it through. How is the flow diagram looking after that? After that, because you pulled it through, this arrow goes into the opposite direction. Yes, and we will have our G trajectories which properly run out, so this guy goes in here and will become the honest to God Gaussian asymptotically free fixed point of these type of non-abelian gauge theories. Okay, so this fraction of the phase diagram has very, very many similarities with conventional QCD flow trajectories or Gage-Yukawa flow trajectories in situations where the gauge theory is still asymptotically free. Okay? Good. Now, I wanted to say, I don't know how much time I still have left. I wanted to say a few more words about this hypercritical surface, because that's something which, of course, we don't choose. It's embedded in the system. So you really have to sit at the fixed point and then study the scaling exponents. And then you realize we have a theory which has one relevant direction, a negative scaling exponent, and three relevant directions. And also these scaling exponents, of course, are now derived as a power series in our small parameter epsilon. Okay? So classically, what this means is classically we have four marginal couplings in this theory, okay? But then quantum mechanically, they develop an interacting UV fixed point, and the fluctuations make sure that three of these three linear combinations are relevant, but one remains relevant. Good. Now, I wanted to say one or two more words about vacuum stability, but I think I've wrapped it up in essence. But really what you need to be doing is, of course, we now have this type of quantic potential. If you look into make the proper stability analysis, and people did that in the past already, you find two areas of global stability. The first one, if single trace and the sum of single and double trace quantic are positive, then the ground state is on the diagonal, and this potential is globally stable. And this is exactly the scenario in which our fixed point lies. There's potentially a second one, namely when the single trace quartic is negative, but this particular sum is positive. So you see in this case, for finite NF, we would need a very big double trace quartic to overcompensate this one. In that case, the vacuum expectation value would distinguish one of the flavor components, okay? But evidently in the large N limit, this case is not applicable for us, because at NF equal infinity, we need either the quartic to be positive or negative at the same time, and that's not possible with the fixed point which itself is non-zero. Okay, so the first scenario is realized here, and therefore we have confirmed that the theory is stable. We even went a step further and played around with resumming systematically logarithmic corrections using Colvin-Weinberg type ideas and computed the corresponding effective potential. And again, we see that the phi to the 4 is never going to be stabilized, and also the minimum remains here at vanishing field. Good. So, to summarize what I wanted to say here, okay, I made a little diagram, an analogy of the diagram I showed you at the beginning for asymptotically free theories. Okay, so I've given you an example and an explicit construction, so an explicit proof of existence, for when four-dimensional quantum field theories with non-abelian gauge fields, scalars, and fermions can develop an interacting UV fixed point. Now, if you try to classify the landscape of asymptotically safe theories, yes, you will see, and that we knew before, scalars by themselves are not becoming asymptotically safe. Scalars with fermions neither. Gauge fields, no, of course, they are asymptotically free. And the U1 is not becoming asymptotically safe on its own. Gauge fields with fermions, no. So the kind of surprising answer here is that we seem to be needing all types of degrees of freedom, non-abelian gauge fields, fermions, and scalars, okay? And if you take one of them away, the entire system falls apart, mm-hmm. Yes? But if you have them on board, they cooperate. They totally cooperate. The scalars are rescuing the non-abelian gauge sector from running into a type of Landau pole, okay? So the Yukawa are rescued by the gauge field, and both of them help the scalar coupling itself to sit on an interacting fixed point. Okay, so it's really each of them depend on the other guys. Okay, now of course this entire picture, okay, up to now, is strict perturbation theory. Okay, so I wanted to show you hard, reliable results. Yes. So of course you might now speculate, because it means that there exist theories beyond the powerful paradigm of asymptotic freedom, right, which may or may not exist in nature. Okay. So this is now, in some sense, open up the territory, perhaps, for phenomenological model building. We no longer need necessarily to rely on asymptotic freedom. There are sample theories which may or may not be available and realized in nature to help out and complement the standard model. Okay. Now, the other thing of where I, for now, can say essentially nothing about, of course, is what is going to happen with these theories at strong coupling. Would it be possible to have this type of behavior even for strongly coupled theories or not? I have absolutely no clue about that. Okay, but it would, I believe it would be very interesting to know these things, in particular because we now have a reliable perturbative starting point. Now, from my angle, of course, a lot of motivation, as I said, has been initiated by trying to get a handle on gravity. Okay, so of course, searching for interacting UV fixed points in gravity is an intrinsic non-perturbative problem, and unfortunately, for now, we are not having very beautiful perturbative tools to actually ask that question. But I don't know. Do I still have time, or have I run out of time? Yeah. So I mean, maybe I've been. It's nearly an hour. Or an hour, actually. So maybe if you give me 5 minutes, I can show you at least a glimpse on how people are at least trying to now be a bit more courageous or ambitious, and see whether this could work in gravity as well. Okay. So if you think of gravity, so remember what I've shown to you in the very beginning. We started out with a very simplistic beta function, tree-level term, and one loop. And of course, back then, Weinberg and collaborators have proven that this type of fixed point does exist in gravity in 2 plus epsilon dimensions. So it's in a, that's one of the main drivers for people to reconsider whether interacting fixed points in gravity may exist in 4 space-time dimensions. Now, what is different if we really want to make this big leap now to 4 dimensions? Okay. So to give you a hint, okay. So, of course, what is different with gravity? We now also have spin 2 degrees of freedom. Okay. And we have a relevant coupling constant which carries mass dimension. And that's, of course, something, yes, which always makes us nervous. Yes, couplings with negative mass dimensions which are perturbatively non-renormalizable. Good. But if the theory becomes asymptotically safe, then the fluctuations might be able to overcome this canonical mass dimension. So how would that look like in gravity? Imagine we have Newton's coupling, but we imagine that we now take it seriously as a running coupling, as we do in QCD and standard model-like couplings. So K is now my RG scale, and I rescale it with an appropriate power of this RG scale. Okay? So this little g is now a dimensionless analog of Newton's coupling. So if I were to be writing down, say, a Kalman-Simoncic type equation for this coupling, I would end up with the following form. It has a factor, d minus 2, multiplied by g, so linear. Remember, it's like the tree-level term we wrote down initially for our beta function. So this term just reminds us of the fact that g Newton has some canonical mass dimension. Now, the true quantum effect is parameterized in the graviton anomalous dimension. So this, in general, will be a very complicated function of all couplings in your theory. Newton's coupling, the cosmological constant, maybe R squared interactions, R cubed interactions, whatnot. Okay? So for this theory to develop an interacting fixed point, yes, an analogy on how this has been derived in 2 plus epsilon dimensions, you would expect, okay, yeah, let's see what are the non-trivial solutions. So clearly there's a solution where the coupling itself vanishes identically, g equals 0. This corresponds to the infrared fixed point of this theory. That's the fixed point where quantum gravity becomes classical, the fixed point of classical general relativity, low energy gravity. Now, if the theory develops an interacting fixed point, it must mean that the anomalous dimension loop effects outbalance the canonical mass dimension. Okay. So this will then generate some sort of implicit equation for the fixed Cauchy star. Now, why is this painful? It's a painful exercise to search for such fixed forms because necessarily the anomalous dimension is going to be large. Okay? Because the theory is interacting, we can no longer rely on canonical power counting. Okay? So one of the beautiful things, thanks to asymptotic freedom, is that we can rely on canonical power counting when we classify operators in the vicinity of the asymptotically free UV fixed point. We can no longer do that, at least not automatically in gravity, because we don't know. We have to find that out first. Okay? Okay? So it means that scaling exponents, I've shown you the scaling exponents for our asymptotically safe Gage-Yukawa theory. Remember, they have all been of order epsilon, our small parameter. But in gravity, we must expect that the scaling exponents remain of order 1. Okay? Good. So there will be strong coupling effects, and we have to think or figure out non-perturbative techniques, yes, in order to be able to ask the question at least in some way, and then let's see how we can systematically improve on that. Good. So what do we know? What are the computational tools available? So of course, there is the lattice. Okay? The lattice is an enormously powerful tool, and it certainly can probably help here. I have one slide, if you're interested, I can tell you a few things about lattice results in these gravitational theories. But we also have continuum methods. And one such very powerful method is the so-called Wilsonian or Polchinski or Wetterich effective action type renormalization group setup. Okay? These are extremely powerful tools, and in fact, some of these tools have already been used to offer proofs of non-perturbative renormalizability in the models I've showed to you earlier, the Gross-Neveu type theories. Okay, so there is a tremendous hope that by exploiting similar technology now for gravity, we might be able to pave the way for understanding gravity better that way. Good. So there's a long list here, incomplete, of people who have contributed to developing this field over the past 10, 15 years. Let me perhaps just give you one example of how results look like if you do these type of studies. Okay, so what is the philosophy? The philosophy is gravity is very complicated. We cannot possibly write down all possible diffeomorphism invariant operators and then systematically analyze their RG evolution. But to break the ice, we have to start somewhere. So what people have been doing is to say, okay, let me restrict myself to some model of quantum gravity and let the model of quantum gravity be a theory where the action, in essence, is only a function of the Ricci scala. Okay? So, of course, it is a model. We have no proof that real quantum gravity is going to look like that. But let's analyze this theory for now. I mean, it's useful because it does contain the cosmological constant, it does contain G Newton, it does contain the R squared coupling, so three of the classically relevant and marginal operators in that theory. But it also includes a lot of higher dimensional operators, which at least classically would be relevant. But we need to see what these are doing non-perturbatively. So the way we've analyzed this system is very much in line to what I discussed a minute ago. So of course, we derive beta functions for all these couplings lambda n. Good. Then we look for interacting fixed points. Okay, we approximate this polynomial expansion for the action up to some highest order, capital N. Yeah? So if we go to N equal 2, it means we have cosmological constant Ricci scala, so Einstein-Hilbert. N equal 3 retains R squared, and so on and so forth. Okay? So each time we analyze the system, look for a fixed point, compute the scaling exponents, and check whether or not we get stable result. And then we start again, include one more invariant, again search for the fixed point, check whether we get a stable result, and so on and so forth. So we've been pushing this computation from n equal 2 up to n equal 35. And the system of equations getting pretty complex, so we used computer algebraic technology to be able to actually analyze it, and we also had to develop some numerical tricks to get the final numbers out at the very end. So this is how the result looks like. So what this plot is showing to you, the coordinates of the fixed point as a function up to which order we have approximated the polynomial action. Okay? And so the way, so for to guide the eye a bit better, so we've plotted the couplings in units of their average value, and then we have shifted them by a small unit so that we can distinguish all the 35 couplings in the very end.
Do these systems close under the RG because you have the other tensor structures we've never seen?
Yeah, no.
So is that like a truncation or projection of some sort?
I'm afraid so, yes. So this means this is the cosmological vacuum energy. This is the coefficient in front of, so minus 1 over G Newton. This is the coupler. This is the R squared coupling, R cubed, and so on and so forth. So the first thing which we observe is that the system, it wiggles a bit initially, but then very rapidly, the more invariants we take into account, it nicely settles somewhere. Okay? So higher order couplings come in, they fluctuate a little bit, they take their time, but then they beautifully settle somewhere. Okay? So we have what we believe is a reasonably stable fixed point. Okay?
If you compare it with the similar to the LPA in the scale field, it's a little amazing that the short the R cubed from very so much. I mean, you have an explanation.
This one?
Yeah, that's very unusual.
The one which was worrisome was the R squared one.
What is in the R squared?
This is the R squared one. And the R squared one comes out very small numerically, close to zero. And it so happens that the R squared one even changes sign initially before settling. So the R cubed converges faster than the R squared. Okay? It just starts somewhere, you know, because simply the initial guess, so to speak, when we solved the fixed point condition wasn't a good guess. Say, and then the system reminds us of that as soon as we include more higher order operators, and then it's going its way. Okay? So, we have a reasonably stable fixed point to very high order. Yes, the nice thing with this, so we were very happy about to see the stability, and I can tell you why. You see, because so many things in these type of systems can go wrong. What can go wrong? Imagine you have a theory which is not having a fixed point. But you're asking the system, do you have a fixed point? If you ask the system in some approximation, it may show you a fixed point simply because you truncate your equations. Okay? So, how can you convince yourself that the fixed point is a feature of your model and not an artifact of your inability to make more sophisticated approximations? Yes? The way to do it is to really go to high order. Because if you go to high order and the fixed point isn't really part of your system, then it is going to deteriorate. And the way fixed points or pseudo-fixed points can deteriorate is simply by showing trends. Suddenly the fixed point disappears, okay? Or in fact, the physical scaling exponents never properly settle. Okay? So this is why we thought that this test is an important test. So now comes the physics. Here, we show you the scaling exponents. Okay, so as we all know, for critical points, the coordinate of the fixed point is largely scheme dependent. These coordinates, yes, at the UV fixed point are not going to be quantities you can measure. Okay, but what you are going to be able to measure are the scaling exponents. So let's compute these. What comes out of here is, well, the picture is reasonably similar. Okay. Fixed point values, I mean the scaling exponents, stabilize. They fluctuate a bit longer, but the amplitude is going down with some decaying exponential hull. Okay, so we have a stable picture here as well. Yeah. Now, and one other thing which is hidden, one other
are
piece
there
of
only two relevant ones?
Sorry?
Only two relevant ones? Is this correct?
Yeah, no, one is degenerate. There are three.
Okay. So, which ones are those?
This is a linear combination, or, well, essentially cosmological constant, Ricci scala, and R squared. Okay? So let me show you the data in one other way, which is this one. And I think that's probably the last plot of my talk. Okay? So what I've done now is I plotted all of these eigenvalues on top of each other, okay, color-coded by the order at which we have approximated the corresponding approximation. Okay, so it's the overlay of all approximation orders up to 35. Now the data is displayed such that the lowest order points, which are the blue ones, have been plotted last. Okay, so why don't you see red points down here? We have red points, but they totally coincide with the low order approximation, which are the blue ones. This is why you don't see them any longer. Okay, and so then we go, so, and the other thing you see from here is that low order approximations carry the relevant ones. High order approximation take the increasingly irrelevant, carry the increasingly irrelevant eigenvalues. So there's one interesting piece of information encoded in this plot. We've learned that despite of the fact that we are looking for an interacting non-trivial UV fixed point, okay, it still seems to be true that canonical power counting, by and large, is actually applicable. Yes, these numbers out here, you see they wiggle a bit, but in essence, this is a narrow bar around Gaussian behavior. So they come out, despite of the fact that it's a highly complicated system, they come out near Gaussian. Okay? So now you can, of course, speculate. And if you say, if you're of an optimistic type, you might be tempted to think, okay, say, if this is really an approximation to real-world quantum gravity, then what this is teaching us is that the system tries to actually become largely Gaussian. It cannot ultimately because of the R-squared interaction, yes, which has a mass-dependent coupling, coupling constant, I mean, inverse mass dimension. So this is the reason for why these low-order couplings cannot settle on Gaussian values. They need to rearrange themselves dynamically. This is affecting the higher order coupling somehow, but not, you know, bringing them totally far away from near Gaussian behavior. So if this is really true, then there might be a chance of maybe identifying a small parameter which is hidden in this behavior, which may help us to ask questions to gravity in a different way, different from how we are doing it up to now. Good. So, I can say a few things relating lattice gravity to these results, but maybe I'm running a tiny bit late, so I can offer that in private discussions if you want. I think there are interesting results. Two groups, Ambjörn, Jurkiewicz and Loll for many years now have been putting forward these dynamical triangulations. They have achieved quite a number of interesting results. There are still also a number of important open riddles, but at least in certain aspects we have managed to make contact with what they seem to be seeing in simulating these surfaces. There's a different type of approach which Herbert Hember has been pushing forward for quite some time, under the name of simplicial quantum gravity. The implementation is a tiny bit different, but again, he claims to have been able to simulate theories of the Einstein-Hilbert type with possibly a smaller squared interaction. And he has been able to measure quantities which play the role of scaling exponents in his lattice theory. Now, we transported that to our RG formulation. Okay, and 1 over the relevant scaling exponent is related to this scaling exponent nu. Okay, so people have been seeing similar numbers there, so they found it quite intriguing. But then again, there are other aspects which don't yet match at all between these two approaches. So there are interesting touching points, but also important open riddles for now. Good. Here are my conclusions. To wrap it up, so I wanted to give you a glimpse of how quantum field theory beyond the paradigm of asymptotic freedom might look like. I've given you an explicit example, but there are many more of this type, yes, available, of four-dimensional metagauge theories. Yes. Now, the really funny thing is that you need all type of degrees of freedom for this to work. Scalars, fermions, and vectors. Okay. It also seems, so many people have asked me that, it also seems that we do not need supersymmetry, and in fact we do not have supersymmetry. We typically have more bosons than fermions. Okay. And so people have tried to construct this for supersymmetric theories, but for now have failed. Okay, but it is still an open question. There might be supersymmetric theories who are also able to display this type of feature. Now, for gravity, of course, the topic is much more challenging. We don't yet have a nice, simple perturbative framework, but quite some progress has been made to perhaps at least get stable results for now, yes, and see how far we can push this forward. Now, the reason for why I wanted to talk about this at your meeting here is this last sentence. I'm wondering whether some of these results might offer opportunities for lattice QCD. So, and that will be my interest at this workshop, like trying to talk to you guys. Okay. So I've seen along on the sidelines perhaps the interesting progress which has been done in recent years in getting the lattice to shed light on conformal fixed points in gauge theories with a certain number of fermion flavors. Okay, so apparently the technology to handle theories of this type seems to be available. I would be keen to understand whether maybe some of what I've been saying today for the non-gravitational theories could be in reach for present-day lattice QCD capabilities. Thank you very much for your attention.
Is anything known about Yang Mills theory in D=5? That would seem like a nice warm up for a lot of this. Okay. Anybody know about
yes. What yes, of course. Yes. So in D=5, there are two results. I could have mentioned one of them earlier already, but on my little list here. So what you can do is you can, since QCD beta function is known up to for loop order, you can make an epsilon expansion, okay, and try to push this computation to epsilon equal 1. Tim Morris from Southampton has done that a decade or so ago. Okay, and so the result of this resummed perturbation theory is to suggest that QCD of this type, yes, actually has an interacting fixed point in 5, but no longer in 6 dimensions. At least there the epsilon expansion definitely breaks down. Although one has to take these results with a grain of salt, since it's a bit like finding the Wilson-Fisher fixed point by doing the very same stuff, and there it works beautifully. Okay, so this is what I think motivated Tim back then. There's a second result, which I believe probably goes beyond this perturbative treatment, which is due to Holger Gies from Jena. So he's been using functional renormalization in some approximation, of course, but he managed to present a computation where an interacting type fixed point for SU2 and SU3 survives up to 5 and potentially to 6 dimensions, say in a more non-perturbative type of approximation.
I just want to mention that I was talking to lattice people doing simulation in 5 dimensions, and at least to me nobody has really seen anything on the lattice so far. I really have to search more.
It's kind of hard because you got to search. As you said, you got to search
the whole parameter right, space. Right. It's very, very time consuming.
Yes.
Nobody has really looked carefully into it.
Right.
Okay. Another question. With the functional normalization, you apply both the gravity and Yang-Mills theory. These theories are hard to regulate in an invariant way. That's why the lattice. I mean, how do you deal with that?
There are several ways to deal with that. Okay, so one of the ways in gravity, certainly for now, is trying to use background field technology. Mm-hmm. Okay, so then you can formally construct a gauge invariant action functional, but at the expense of having to deal with more fields and then controlling that gauge symmetry.
I guess when you use the background field, it's like two gauge symmetries, the background gauge symmetry and the core gauge symmetry, and one you can keep, but the other one, I think, still has the original problem. That is, you need to keep both of them.
No. Yeah? One is for free, the background gauge symmetry.
Right, okay.
Okay. But at the instant where you identify, say, the expectation value of the quantum field mm-hmm. with the background field, you can construct an action which only depends on one field. Mm-hmm. So then the gauge symmetry is fully inherited by the argument of that action. Now, if you do it this way, there is a price to be paid at another location in this formalism, which is that then you have to be very careful in controlling what your second variation of your action functional with respect to the propagating fields actually is. Okay? Of course, there are other ways to do it. Yes, and so people have tried to formulate it for gauge invariant variables. Okay, so in principle that can be done, but the price then is going to be that the flow is going to have non-localities in momentum space, because typically the projection, so to speak, introducing gauge invariant variables, these are a complicated function of the original field, so inverting these things will induce momentum non-localities. Okay, so people have been working on this a lot in the late 90s and early 2000s, precisely because that's such an important question. Okay, so as a rule of the thumb, there is no free lunch. Yes, there are several things you can do, and a tiny bit depends on what is most efficient for the problem you're trying to attack. But what people also tend to do is they can exploit the flexibility of the functional renormalization group to use as many implementations as they want, because the physics, at the end of the day, must be insensitive to it. Yeah, so there are ways to check, make consistency and reliability checks of the various approximations and the maintenance of gauge or diffeomorphism symmetry.
Yeah, so I was going to ask, so in this, the trajectory going up to the, that way?
Yes.
Northeast?
Yes.
So if epsilon is very small, mm-hmm. then this basically looks like QCD.
Absolutely, yes.
In experimental realization, you could never tell the difference if epsilon is very small.
Well, very good point. So here we go. Yes, of course. If you see, there are two things you must distinguish. Yes, here the epsilon is really a poor theoretician's tool to get the foot in the door. Okay, whether nature is offering us so many fields so that epsilon is small, we have no clue. Okay, so but then this will then yes, I mean it's our functions of epsilon. So I mean you can read them. Yeah. But you see.
Does it start with the G square there?
What?
The beta function and the non-trivial is
four. No, it's linear.
So then it is not QCD like because QCD starts with.
That's true, but the coefficient is still parametrically small. You're absolutely right. Okay? So it is not the running is different. The running is different. Okay? In one case, it's like logarithmic. In the other case, it's power like with a very small exponent. You can distinguish if you make very precise measurements. But I mean, the physics point, I think, is a real one. I mean, you could say, let's go back to where we started. Let's say we are experimentalists. Okay? So imagine we have measured this curve. Okay? Now, as an experimentalist, of course, I don't believe anything which a theoretician is telling me. Okay? So how do I know that this curve really goes to zero? Okay, so it may very well be that in some extended version of QCD, this curve, in fact, because we haven't measured it beyond this point, is not going to zero, but to some tiny small number, due to the fact that maybe further degrees of freedom exist. Yeah, this is something we don't know at present.
So to define an interacting scalar in four dimensions, you can try to follow the flow in the node in this direction.
Yeah.
You have hint of problems, or and here's an example, right? Bardeen and Moshe Bender, they found a unific point, and then they have argument to show that there's a problematic continuum limit on the other side.
Yes.
Do you have any
No. I mean, the only, if anything at that fixed, so, on the trajectory which goes to strong coupling,
okay,
if anything goes wrong there, I can't say much because I'll be leaving perturbation theory. In the domain where perturbation theory is valid, nothing crazy is happening. Okay? But once we leave that territory, I don't know. I would not expect from the structure of the theory, I wouldn't expect wild things to go on. I mean,
the stable manifold, there's no old. You can calculate it technically.
Yeah. Yes. It looks fine in perturbation theory.
It's a similar trigger.
Yes. Yes.
Okay, any other questions?
Yeah. It's okay, I'll ask later. No, well, let me just ask it because that connects to the functional realization approach. Could you apply it to the system that you describe perturbatively?
Of course.
The scalar Yukawa gauge system.
Yeah.
What does FRG predict there?
We are presently doing it. So I can't.
I wonder if it is a good way to test or to compare two alternative.
Yes, of course. In their domain of validity, they totally agree with. And so, as you know, the functional RG does reproduce perturbation theory. Yes, very systematically to all loop orders.
But
nevertheless, we started with my students. We started looking into this system using the FRG. And the reason for why we wanted to do it is A, because of confirmation, and B, because we want to take more perturbatively irrelevant operators into account, just to see what is going to happen in this theory. So, say higher order invariance in the scalar sector
As you added more and more operators, those were not only irrelevant, but acted like as naive power counting, dimensional power counting, described them correctly. Yeah. Is that true for the scalar Yukawa system as well?
We have to verify that, but I would expect that it is.
Yes. Four operators, one of them is relevant.
So I'm totally confident that this is going to come out, but it needs to be checked. So you can say if this is the scaling dimension of whatever your nth operator, say h dagger h cubed, right, which would be an irrelevant one. Okay. So of course it has some Gaussian value, but if I subtract this, this is going to be order epsilon.
Yeah.
Okay. But it is important just to, you know, check how and confirm how these things in detail work through to make sure that nothing is going wrong in other places.
So just to comment on the lattice part.
Yeah.
If anyone on the lattice takes this issue up, it is much easier than what we do in infrared spots that we have been discussing, because you are talking about a fixed point that is truly ultraviolet. So we were just looking. We will be looking for a phase transition, a second order phase transition, and that's infinitely easier to understand than an infrared fixed point that is really just there in our imagination. So I think that's a very good point. The lattice calculation for this kind of systems would be much.
Yeah. Well, yes. As I said, I would be very keen on learning a bit more on what can be done and what cannot maybe be done. From the phase diagram, say, those of you who have worked with critical systems, yes, you will recognize this is very similar to a simple Wilson-Fischer fixed point. If you plot it in terms of the dimensionless quartic and the dimensionless mass, yes, and it also has a one-dimensional critical surface. So in many aspects, say in view of its critical behavior, I would not be surprised if it displays things like look-alike second-order phase transitions in the vicinity of that point.
Is a second-order phase transition. There is no question about
it. Okay, so we thank Daniel.